are going on a road trip.
Who's with me?
Can you dig it?
We're on a mission from God.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
Hey, I'm Brian Duffy.
And I'm Russell Davis.
And this is Road Rash. What is Road Rash? Road Rash is Russell Davis and Brian Duffy traveling around the world, something we've done for the last couple of years, so much so that people are dying to know what some of our experiences are. Two guys who literally live life to the fullest. You can't beat this. You can't get past this.
Guys, come out, eat, drink, travel with us. Every episode, including this week, we're going to have special guests.
Every Tuesday night, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard.
From a different location around the world.
Don't be a rash hole. Get your devices ready.
Come on out, all you rash holes. Every Tuesday, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard.
Hey, I'm Brian Duffy.
And I'm Russell Davis.
We're going to eat, drink, and travel. This is Road Rash.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to the Road Rash podcast. This week, January 19th, we've got Danielle Von Scheiner, the one and only cider mistress for Big Apple Hard Cider out of New York, the only one that exists in the world, and Mr. Duffy, who you got?
We get to hang out this week with my buddy, Chef Keith Breedlove, who owns the Culinerdy Cruiser, a really cool food truck up in Sacramento. Really good guy to talk to, a lot of fun, pretty aggressive. I'm stoked.
And, guys, we're talking bar fights, the stumble of Per Se, and what Thomas Keller's going to do. And don't forget to tune in next week because we got a huge guest, Mr. Phil Hellmuth, 14-time World Series Poker Champion. Road Rash, boys and girls, eat, drink, travel.
Eat, drink, travel. Time for some Road Rash.
Okay, guys, so really excited to have the world's first cider mistress on the show today, guys. This is Danielle Von Scheiner, and she is the owner, the person that makes the actual cider for a company that's coming out in New York called Big Apple Cider. Also, what's really cool is that her and I are starting to do a little bit of work. I'll be creating a recipe for the launch of this new brand, and she's also, more than anything, a fan of Road Rash Podcast. Danielle, thank you so much for coming on.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
So wait a second, Danielle. Russell gets to create a cocktail or something involving the cider, and what do I get to play with food or what's?
Sure,
what's
let's do a pairing.
I'm all for it. I just used cider this afternoon because I knew you were coming on. I'm upstairs right now. I'm doing pork chops. I marinated them in cider.
Perfect.
Yes. So I do a lot. I cook a lot with booze. So.
Well, I've got test batches that I actually can't use because they came out a little bit too cinnamony.
Yeah.
So I've offered that to Prohibition Bakery if they want to make a hard cider cupcake.
Oh,
so
there you go.
We'll see about that.
That's awesome.
Yes. Awesome.
So
well, you know, I wanted to dig in before we actually start talking to cider too much with you, but just kind of open you up a bit. But let's get to know you. What do you like to eat? Where do you like to travel? And what do you like to drink besides cider?
Hmm. Cider's a big one, my friend.
a big mouthful right there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's New York. You can get anything at any time of the day, night, evening. And the wonderful thing about New York is that things disappear and come up. They pop up, and there are so many different places to eat here. I'm local. I'm in the village. So, you know, if you love a good slice of pizza, there's Ben's Pizzeria. There's a dollar slice.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want a fantastic beer, you're going to go to Blind Tiger and get some of their wonderful nibbles and Murray's Cheese Shop, which, you know, you can get some fantastic ciders, and then they'll pair them with some really funky cheeses. And those are
that sounds
really
delicious.
Yeah, they're fantastic. So, I mean, it's really a culinary mecca here, and things change all the time. So, yeah, you get really, really spoiled in New York with, you know, really anything you want to eat and drink. But my favorite place is another great little cocktail bar right across the street, Pegu Club.
Mm-hmm. That's legendary. Pegu Club is one of the most legendary bars there.
Yeah,
is.
They're kind of amazing. Downstairs is Carboni's, so these guys are awesome, and they do a lot of testing of my cider for me.
Research. Yet another project I wasn't invited to.
Just keep talking shit on me, guys. Keep not inviting me to things.
Come downstairs. If I ever make a test batch or something like that, I'll run them downstairs to the guys and you know, see if they like something or you know, you just get some feedback. And they're really nice because it's a little tit for tat because, you know, I give them cider and then they're out all night and they take care of my motorcycle in the summer. So
wait
like
a second.
What
do you ride?
I ride a Royal Enfield 500.
What? That is awesome.
I'm so riding. We should go riding this summer.
Yes.
I swear to God, I have an 07 Street Bob, so I'm a Harley guy.
Oh, of course you are.
Yeah. Well, I mean, come on. Put this body on a little rice rocket isn't going to happen.
I just got rid of my 06 Dyna Super Glide, but in the process of getting a new bad boy. So.
Yeah. Well, okay.
I mean, they're gorgeous. The Royal Enfield classics. If you haven't seen them, check them out. They're old. Yeah, just look it up. That's what I'm doing. They're so beautiful. And I mean, it was really one of the motivations for me to start making cider. You know, they say we all have two lives. The second begins the when you realize that you only have one.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. We'll get into that on my end a little bit, but yeah, I totally agree with you. Agree with you.
So I was working in advertising and I was running to a meeting uptown on my bike and it was a little bit slippery out. It had just rained and I got smashed from behind with a cab. And I ended up in the hospital and I said, it was like, wow, okay, this isn't a run through. Let's do something and let's take a chance. So, but honestly, got back on the bike.
Yeah, you have to.
Yeah, you really have to. Took a few really intensive, you know, courses on defense driving in the city. But it's like a game of Tetris, like where everything can kill you.
Yeah, it totally is.
Yeah,
it is. It's like watching a video game. I watch just the messengers ride through the city. You know, I'm sitting in the back of a cab or an Uber or something like that. And you're like, holy shit, come on, man, slow
down.
Those
guys are nuts. Those guys are absolutely nuts.
Yeah.
You have to drive a little nuts to be here because you've got to get in front of all the traffic that could potentially turn on you. But there's so many cabs that are going left, right, stopping all the time. So you're constantly bobbing and weaving. But I honestly think it's so meditative because the one time you can need to shut off all of your devices, you have to concentrate on the road.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you can zip out to the city. Like you can zip upstate and have a really great time.
We're so riding this summer.
Yes.
Absolutely. I swear to God, because I'm on my I first got a bike about 5 years ago. I had no idea what I was doing. I was sitting in a Harley dealership getting ready to do a promo for these guys for a whole bunch of food and stuff. And I kept looking at the bikes and the owner of the dealership kept looking at me. And he's like, do you want to test ride one? I'm like, I've never been on a bike. I have no idea. I don't even know how to ride. So 2 hours later, I finished signing the papers and they dropped the bike off. This was Tuesday. They dropped the bike off at 7:30 Saturday morning. And the guy's like, have you ever ridden before? I said, I've never ridden. He's like, all right, brake, clutch and gas. Good luck. And I took it to a parking lot with a buddy of mine. And the next day I rode 140 miles and I put 6,000 miles on my bike that summer. And then the next summer I put about 600 because it just got nuts. So yeah.
And after that first long ride, after you first learn, there's like nothing can get your mind off of wanting to get back on it.
Oh, I was riding everywhere. Like, oh, hey, I got to go to the grocery store and I've got to buy a gallon of milk. Look, I'll buy two halves because I can fit them in the side bags. Yeah, there we go. I mean, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Look, you're purposely forgetting things at the grocery store, so you have to go back.
Yep.
I mean, now you guys ride you travel so much. There's Eagle Rider.
Yes.
Fantastic. And you can rent a bike. You can rent any type of bike all over the world.
Yeah.
And this summer I had gone to Portland. I wanted to ride Mount St. Helens and then all the way down to, I was in Seattle and I drove down to Portland and I saw a friend of mine, Reverend Nat, and he's got a little cider house outside of Portland. And
oh, cool.
He's fantastic. And so, I mean, it was just, it's being able to kind of get out on a bike and do that.
Well, I just did Vegas to Lake Havasu. So I rode through the Mojave Desert and then back down in through Route 66 and did all of that stuff, which was awesome. And I actually was the number two guy on a a charity run that went from Fresno all the way up to China Peak in the top of the Sierra Forest, which was insane.
Nice.
Insane. Like, police escort the whole way in, like, did not stop the entire ride. And I was, like, the number two guy, and there were 1,000 bikers.
Nice.
It was unbelievable. And the whole time, I was just, one of the guys behind me took a video, and he's like, I have no idea how you paid attention, because the whole time you were just like head going back and forth, because I didn't want to miss anything. And then I got to ride back by myself the next morning, and it took me 4 hours just to get back into Fresno. And I did as much as I could, but it was an awesome, awesome ride. So, and I never would have done it if, I mean, what would I have done, you know, 5 years prior if I hadn't done that? So, yeah. Yeah. So totally. So we're doing that. We're going to ride this summer. I'm going to come up to New York and we're going to take off.
Good. Damn. Now I'm getting left out. I've got to fly in for this one.
Yeah. You weren't invited on that one, Russell. Just so you know, you're busy that week.
Yeah. I'm just going to have to rent the bike. And just
apparently you're filming that week, Russell. You're filming.
I'm going to have to start my own gang.
Yeah, exactly. Your own gang. Dude, can I tell you, you ready for this? You know what the name of my gang, quote unquote? Boink, boink, my gang around here, we're the Frozen Nutticles. Because the first time we all went riding, like a whole group of us had gotten together, it was like November, and we had gone out for the day, and it was a beautiful day. It was like 50 degrees, and then as soon as the sun went down, it was like 12.
Oh.
And we had the worst ride coming back down the Pennsylvania Turnpike, and it was brutal. It was so – I had to stop at a Walmart and buy a camouflage headset so that I could cover my face. It was bad. Yeah. So.
I've done that, though.
Yeah.
When you have to go and you go to the CVS and they have long sleeve sweatshirts and you buy like six of them.
Yeah. Or the little hand warming pocket things. They're my favorite.
you can make holes in the sweater to like to pull it up.
The makeshift Lululemon.
It's really nice in the morning and now it's like, ugh.
But you dread if once you see that sun starting to come down and you start hitting those little valleys and stuff, and it just gets. Russell's like, "What are you talking about? I'm from Texas and I live in California. Oh, I have no idea what cold is."
Luckily, I drove across the country for 9 months. Did. Yeah. So, but yeah, I was the same. I mean, I did a stretch from an I-20 from Shreveport, Louisiana, to Dallas, Texas, in like 19 degree weather, and it was just misting enough so every time I put my feet down, and all the icicles would chunk underneath, crush underneath my boots. So, I totally understand those rides.
But no, we and Russell and I have talked because we're going to start doing some actual road rash stuff, where we're going to try and get some tours together to go across country. And one of the things that we had said was we just need a trailer with the bikes on the back. Like, literally, that's it. And I'll be a happy guy, very happy guy with that. So
but if they want to throw in a Jeep too, that's great.
Absolutely, but we need like a 78 CJ. You know, like something old school. Not my 2016 Wrangler.
Yeah, no, 93 to 95 Wranglers. Those are the perfect years.
Yeah.
Perfect years.
So, Danielle, what are you still in advertising?
I'm freelance every once in a while. I'm fully self-funded on this cider venture of mine. Yeah.
You're so busy.
It's a lot. I mean, it's been a lot of nights and weekends, but I work with I work, you know, and until this is launching and it's making a little bit of money, we're I'm gonna continue to do freelance. So yeah, I'm a strategist and media buyer and do second screen for a bunch of different agencies. So
that's cool.
So you came from a family of winemakers. What made you? I mean, what developed this love for cider and make you go that direction as opposed to doing the traditional, what your family was doing?
Well, I mean, cider is ADD wine.
As all three of us are going, oh, I get that now.
Totally,
okay.
Understand, yeah.
Right. So growing up, you know, there's wine in the basement, granddad's doing wine and making gnocchi and things like that. And absolutely just, it was always something around, but pretty much you can ferment anything. Anything with sugar in it, you know, yeast eats sugar and creates alcohol. So if it was strawberry wine or dandelion wine or anything that was local, and I grew up state New York, so apples were prevalent. Like I said, I can make a 13% like apple wine, like nobody's business. But
your house, your neighbors must love you.
Yeah.
Just the scents alone that are coming out.
Oh, right.
Maybe not all the sense.
Well, the bulk of it happens upstate. But I do have two 40-gallon conical fermenters in my test kitchen here.
Really?
Yeah. So
that's the way to do it. That's like me. I've got. Oh, are you showing us?
I can show you them.
No shit, that's awesome, Russell. I wish to God you could. Don't move that yet. I gotta get a picture of that. Where the hell's my phone?
Picture it, post it.
Where's my phone?
Post it now.
Oh, it's there. It is. That is an absolute riot. This hold on, like Danielle, can you get your right face now in there?
Yeah.
Oh.
That is the best.
Yeah. I can get the fist in there.
This is so classic, dude.
Get it. So this is awesome. What's also cool about it is you are...
Okay, I got you.
You're one of the few female, if not the only female, cider master out there, really, right?
Yeah, I got yelled at for calling myself a cider mistress in the very beginning because... We're cider nerds. Like, everybody is... No. There's no feminine. There's it's only the masculine. You are only a cider master. And I was like... Because I knew there was just like one other girl that I had met and from like Sea Glass Cider up in like Nova Scotia, and she's amazing. And I was like, Karen, you're another cider mistress. And all the guys were like, no. But then again, like I was telling Russell, like I don't wear flannel. I don't have a big beard. I don't fit in with the rest of the cider, the cider
stereotype.
Yeah, I got the stereotype, you know, okay. And they're great. I love them all. They're fantastic. It's just, it's you walk into a room and you're like, hey, I make cider. People are like, really? Okay. So
you're not just the rep?
No.
Because you know you get that. You know you get that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They're like, really? Why? And like, it's a question. Why do you make cider? Because I have been making cider and I like making cider. And like I said, it's so much different than it's so great to give somebody something that you've actually made. And one of the things that I believe in is connection. And when you can stop what you're doing, put a phone down, and you can have a drink with somebody, it's the most incredible experience. You get to learn about that person. You get to stop what the city is doing and really kind of have a second with somebody. And that's where I like making cider and I like making alcohol, really. And it's just being able to kind of connect with other people. And in New York, I'm not going to say we're not very friendly, but there are people that they have things to do. They've got places to go, things to do, things to see. Yep. And so so sometimes you know the opportunity to be inclusive with the city, like everyone's a New Yorker. If you watch Saturday Night Live, you are a New Yorker when you watch that show.
That's a great way to put that. I instantly had a connection to that.
I want it when you drink a Big Apple Hard Cider that you're a New Yorker.
There you go.
And we love that.
So that's it, you know.
That's the way to go. I love it. So what?
I love that.
what made you decide to move into that world?
Like I said, there's a little bit of a near-death experience that...
You just said, I'm going to do it, yeah.
That pushed me over the edge, like, well, you know what, let's try this. I had the opportunity. My dad was thinking about retiring. I said, I really love to spend more time with you. And what do you think about doing this on a larger scale? And he said, you know, he's like, yeah, whatever, do what you do. You know, like, he thought it was like a nights and weekends thing until we got a first cease and desist letter from one of the big guys' legal teams.
Really? Saying
that they needed to hold our trademark for 8 months or 9 months so they could review it. And I was like, oh my God, we're on their radar. We haven't even launched yet. Like this.
Yes. So we finally pissed someone off.
Exactly.
I don't know what this is, but that's a good thing.
It is. It's a great thing.
Oh, it's fantastic. So we got that letter and I freaked out. I was so happy. And I was like, okay, sure. Let's move on. And last year I got my trademark. And so I'm legit.
Congratulations.
I made sure that I was not a Gambino. Like I was like, absolutely. Like I was legit. So now I can and create and distribute. And it's nice. It's nice being, because you either come to cider making from either the beer angle, and I feel like beer guys are engineers, and winemakers and cider makers, we're like artists.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Whatever, you know, bring a little to it.
Yeah.
and I know, and cider is the definition of cider is you can have half sugar water and half fruit, pressed fruit. I've only made my cider with pressed fruit, and it's okay. A little bit more expensive, but you can taste the difference. And when you come from a wine background and you can taste what additives are and what, you know, and how people are trying to speed up a process, and they're not, you know, and it really does make a huge difference. So I mean, bringing this product to market has been 3 years in the making, and it's been a ton of, let's do a CiderCon, let's do a festival, let's have an R&D with people that live here and make a cider that people love, and really make sure that it is 100% natural New York State apples, and everything is fresh pressed fruit. There's no additives to it, and it tastes fantastic. And so that's kind of the idea of it. And then so our original is coming out in draft in March 2016. And then what I was thinking about was, or what I had done, is create a real New York City cider versus kind of New York State cider,
mm-hmm.
Partnering with three different New York City like whiskey distilleries.
Oh, cool.
So I'm casking nine different types of cider from Brooklyn Distillery, Van Brunt Stillhouse and Kings County. Those will be ready in September.
So those are going to be your extensions of the line, are going to be these cask age ciders that are have the finishes of these whiskeys on them.
Yeah. Yeah. They're
amazing.
I mean, because they get all oaky and there's a little funk to them. They've got this like crystalline flavor, and it's like these undertones of like of bourbon or maple or whiskey or moonshine, whatever it cured in those barrels.
So, and then you get that natural tannins of the wood anyway too. You get the wood.
Yeah, it's been fun.
So I want to do a dinner with it.
Yeah.
I would love to do something fun. I've got clients up in New York in the city as well as in the suburbs, Long Island and out in Nyack and stuff like that we could have a lot of fun with, that they would promote the shit out of it.
It's because cider is still a discovery drink in America. In the UK, mm-hmm. you have two choices. It's beer or cider, yeah. Right? Everybody's drinking one or the other. Here, we're still kind of discovering it, and that's why, Russell and I started talking, because we wanted to make sure that people got what they wanted, and the discovery portion of it is still so important. So New York, Manhattan, we're such a cocktail culture. Mm-hmm. We love our cocktails, and we love to be able to mix a cocktail. So let's, in the beginning of the night, let's go to Bathtub Gin, and you can mix a cocktail with a Big Apple. And then as, you want to kind of, slowly take it down a notch, maybe you just want to drink that cider alone for the rest mm-hmm. of it. And so really kind of formulated it so you can drink five, six, and seven of them, even though it is a higher alcohol content. It's about 6.5 ABV. So
nice.
I love it. So how do you feel now, you coming from this wine background and literally like taking this from a wine point of view too, how do you feel about the cider glass? Because I've read articles that argue that you should taste cider in a wine glass. A lot of people don't like the fact that a lot of people just put them in the traditional pint glasses. And then there's actually the cider glass, which has been released, which looks kind of like a combination of a bulb on a column, basically. So it's like almost like a wine meets a pint glass in a way. What's your perspective on it all?
I think it's sticky. I mean,
yeah. I agree.
I mean, the same thing is like, I want this to be very accessible. It's very inclusive, I think that when somebody calls something like a chalice, you don't need to drink out of a chalice. You can drink out of
Little John does.
A Red Solo. Just didn't get to cut it. Or are we good? Little John.
Oh, Jesus. I think it's wonderful, but it does bring some the auspice of something that's a little bit more glamorous or special to it. But honestly, people need to be drinking more cider. Just drink more cider, and that would be fantastic. I don't care what glass you're using. But
I love that.
Well, just to give you a little note here, just so you guys know that there people are drinking more cider because there was a 75% increase from 2013 to 2014 in cider sales. Yeah, just absolutely. In sales alone, that was just shy of $500 million. And it increased this past year to $1.2 billion, which was a change of just a little bit over 5% from the year prior to that. But 75% increase within a one-year time frame of the knowledge and the acceptance of ciders. So that's pretty awesome. So
it's a big revolution right there.
Yeah.
It is, but still out of the beer market or the craft beer market, we are still only – we have 1% of the craft beer market.
Right. Yeah, so you guys are 1.2%.
We still have a long way to go in order to get people to drink some cider.
Yeah. You know? Domestic premiums are at 44%. Domestic sub premiums and imports are at 15%. And ciders are down at 1.2.
Yeah, I know.
Malt liquor, baby, that's up there at 1.6. Working hotter than a whore on nickel night. Yep. They
drink
love their malt liquor.
Everything.
What'd you say?
Just drink more everything, people.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's pretty funny to see some of the names that are in here and who's rocking and rolling doing some of the stuff that they're doing. I mean, you know, the bigger ones are still crushing it with what they have. So I'm excited to see what your product does and how it moves in. So you got a great story behind it, and you seem like a pretty intelligent person. So I'm kind of stoked to watch this grow.
Yeah, yeah. And a cider master that's going to ride in on a motorcycle and does what you do, that's just – you got it all going on right now. I think it's going to be really cool.
That is awesome. So when do you launch officially? In March?
Early March. We're just it's just tweaking this final formulation so we can get it rolling.
That's cool.
Nights and weekends and every day.
Yeah.
And I'm going to have to test these cocktails on you, Duffy, when I see you next.
Oh no, please no. Not more cocktails from Russell. Oh no. No, does that mean I have to bring food to serve Russell? Awesome.
Yay! I can't wait.
Russell and I are heading to Reno and next week with our partners from Relax Just Create. We've got a crazy project going on out there in Reno. It's actually called Reno Project right now. So if you're on Twitter and all that stuff, you can definitely find it. But Danielle, you're a rock star. I like you. You're fun. So,
I can't wait to go riding with you.
Yeah, no, I'm like, I've got a whole bunch of days that I've just kind of got planned to take some rides, and I haven't done a whole lot of New York State. My last awesome ride was up along Route 6, which runs just south of the New York border. And it's an amazing run that runs all the way along the water. And then we actually cut up into New York where friends of ours, they have a bed and breakfast up there, but it's a skydiving bed and breakfast.
Ooh.
So it's an Aussie and this like kind of this just really cool chick from she's from the East Coast, like more towards Philly. But they literally their landing strip is just it's a field. It's a farm. And it's just they like mow the lawn before they have to go and take off for the day. But they have, and you get in there and they cook for you. And it's a beautiful, beautiful ride up in. It's really a great ride. So I would love to ride with you. So we'll have some fun. Yeah.
And my gang will be there before you get there just to cut off the path, just to let you know.
Well, I'll show you where the best places are to get tickets for speeding along that route if you guys want, because I got two of them in 2 days. So I got one heading out and one heading right back in. So it worked out really well for me. Yeah, it was great.
You know, isn't prostitution legal there? So
where? In New York or in?
In Reno.
Oh, really? Where the hell did that come from?
Yeah, that was a tangent.
What field? That was even left field. That was so far outfield.
Where was the segue there?
Russell's porn show.
What? Wait a second. Russell's what?
Russell's drinking porn show. From
oh, Jesus Lord! No way.
Oh, you're trying to figure out what we were talking about with our interview with Miss Alexis.
Well, you heard
about
the interview.
The porn. Yeah,
oh,
yeah.
That's right. Okay, I remember.
Yeah.
You're going to Reno. There's something's gonna happen.
Do we need to get Alexis in on this call?
Yes.
She's on her way to the Apple store, so I don't think she's gonna hop on a Skype call real quick.
The irony.
I know. Oh, there you go. Look at that. I like it. I like it a lot.
I love it.
That's cool. So Danielle, what do you want to tell us? What do you got for us? No, I have a question. I got a question. So what is the craziest Well, that's going a little. What's the craziest travel experience you've had?
I was almost arrested in Fez.
Really?
Yeah. I
love the way that sounds.
Yeah.
So I was in school, and it was a school trip, and I was doing a project on human trafficking.
Okay.
And so in Morocco, if you want to talk to women of the night, then you usually you go into bars and you basically get, you know. And I met some guy, and he's from NYU, and he was a translator. And I was like, this girl is beautiful. And there, you know, she was this gorgeous, gorgeous prostitute. And I said, I'd really love to take your picture and like record it for this project, the school project that I'm doing. And she said, okay, great. And I brought her out to the lobby of this hotel that we were staying at. And all of a sudden, the guy behind the desk said, you know, we don't want our country represented this way. This is a huge problem. The guy from NYU was translating. He was like, okay, this is not a problem. The guy tried to grab my camera and brought out a gun. He was like, go back to your room, go back to your room, go back to your room. And I was like, these are the best pictures I've ever taken in my life. And of course, I like wanted to continue. The next morning, my professor knocked on my door and said Interpol had been called. And the trip almost got shut down.
That's awesome. I love it.
Yeah,
that's a good one.
That's a good story.
That's a winner right there.
That's a fucking winner.
Yeah.
Don't do that.
Stay away from that one.
My professor was great. She was just like, next time, don't bring people out of the bar. No.
Yeah, no. That's with a $20 bill in your hand.
Yeah, exactly.
It just doesn't work. And a camera. No, it's not cutting it. Not cutting it. All right,
goodbye to Hollywood.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so favorite food.
Favorite food.
Apples.
Right. No, honestly, like my favorite, my comfort drink is blue cheese stuffed olive martini, straight up.
Okay.
Like sapphire, it's just if that's like the comfort food at the end of the night.
Okay.
Duffy's got a thing against blue cheese stuffed olives.
I do. It's not that I have a thing against them. I just don't want them in my damn drink. When I order a vodka soda with three olives in it, I'm not asking. Yeah. No.
You don't want really good, clean, healthy food like Quantum Leap down the street.
Yeah.
It's like Quantum Leap Cobb salad. Like everything's just super.
I've been there. It's good. They have great food down there.
They have really good food.
I was up there this past summer when I was up in New York doing some stuff. So
you know my hood.
I do know your hood. I do. I love New York. I'm a massive I absolutely love New York. So every opportunity I was amazing. Just up there for I did the whole Christmas Eve thing and I did the parade, like I did it all. And I do St. Patrick's Day in New York every year for the Today Show and all that stuff. So I'm a big, big fan. And in reality, if I want to spend the $110, it's an hour away. If I want to sit back and chill for a couple minutes and spend $56, it's an hour and 12 minutes away. So I'm good. I'm good. If I want to spend $60 and take 3.5 hours, I can drive. Yeah. So
well, there really is a magic to the city, but also the entire state's just pretty amazing too.
Yeah, big time. Finger Lakes, I love going out there. Yeah, I'm a big fan. Big fan of New York.
It really is New York City is a completely different world than anywhere else in New York. And when we say upstate, it's anything higher than like 150th Street. So you can be in New York City and Brooklyn, and then there's like upstate is everything else, and that's where I mean New York is one of the biggest apple producing states in America. So we have, but I mean there's a lot of differences between the cider that we produce and everywhere else. Like you know Seattle and Pacific Northwest, they're all about creating, specialty beers from their cider. So they'll hop their ciders. They'll create malted ciders and things like that. And then in the middle of the country, like Michigan and that area, Wisconsin, there's a lot of fruit forward ciders. in New York State specifically, we're really heavily into our heritage apples. We like varietal ciders. So it's all of these old ciders that have and old trees that have been ripped up during Prohibition are getting a new life in New York State. Me coming from a wine background, it's like every crop is different, every orchard is different. I can make anything, you know, with alcohol out of something with sugar. So if it's got a great, if it's got the right pH and it's got the right sugar content, I can make a cider out of it. I can make a wine out of it. So, but yeah, so that's why there's a lot of differences going on in the world of cider, and New York has its own little flavor. But we've got 250 cider makers in New York that that do this, but only one in the city.
There you go. I love it. I love it. Yeah. Well, Russell, you got anything else for our friend?
You know, not really. Besides, Danielle, I'm just so excited to be doing this cocktail work with you, and so excited you came on the show and that you're a fan, and so excited you got to meet Duffy too. Synergy there. So,
and I'm so glad that I don't have any involvement whatsoever in all these other side projects that you guys have going on. Other than we're going for a ride this summer, Russell, and we're not going to tell you what day. That's how I feel about that. So, Danielle, hey, next time I'm up at the city, I'd love to grab a drink. I'm up there quite a bit. And what we should do is me, you, and Eric Castro should go over to his place.
Yeah, Boilermaker.
Yeah, absolutely. Go over there and have some cocktails. That'll be fun.
Anytime. Cool. So, myself,
hey, Danielle, how can we, how can everybody who listens, both of the people that listen besides me and Russell, get in touch with you?
You can follow me on Twitter at Big Apple Cider, or you can go to our website and sign up for our newsletter, BigAppleCider.com, BigAppleHardCider.com. And then I started a new Twitter handle today because I realized nobody could really get in touch with me. So
what's your Twitter?
It's Cider Mistress.
Ooh, how you doing?
Like, what up, what up?
Yep, you're going to get a whole different group of followers on that one, my friend. Do you have an alter ego by chance?
That should be it.
Named Patricia Keating?
No, Cider _ Mistress. You hate the underscores.
I hate the underscore. Cider.
Oh, so wait, there's another Cider Mistress without an underscore out there? We need to eliminate her.
Yes, we need to get rid of her.
Yeah.
What's her name? She is so gone. It's Cider Mistress. We're literally going to start spamming her right now.
Yeah, what's her real name? Patricia? Patricia, you need to get out of that handle.
Patricia, right. We need to check. Hold on. She has one follower, dude. We are so taking this over.
We're gonna get rid of that underscore.
I have
for you
like
real
one
quick.
Follower on mine right now.
But now you have two. We're good. We got you covered. Yep. You have five. You're crushing it right now. For only starting this morning, you have five followers.
That's about the
took
same
me like a week
for the podcast. So. No.
Also, Instagram, follow us on. You know, get in touch with me. Email me. Anything. So any love you can show to Big Apple, that's great. And look for us in some select bars and tell people you like us. So
yeah, I love it.
I cannot wait to hang out with you. I'm in New York. So
yeah, we'll have fun. That'll be a blast. That'll be good.
Cool.
So all right, well, awesome. Danielle, Russell, Russell's your introduction, but I'm going to finish this up. So I want to say thank you so much for hopping on with us and taking some time, showing us your living room there and hanging out with the puppy and all the good stuff. It was a pleasure talking to you, and I love your passion and your heart for what you've got going on up there, and the fact that you're doing something awesome right down there in the city and in the village is great, and I'm stoked to ride with you.
Yeah, I can't wait. It's great. Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. It was great talking to you.
Awesome. Take care, Danielle.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.
One of the things that I really wanted to talk about this week was everything that happened with Per Se. So you know Per Se, right?
Yes, I know Per Se, but I have not heard of what happened this week. Maybe I'm a little out of the loop. Please,
okay.
Inform
so,
me.
So Per Se was one of the biggest, most well known restaurants. You know, there's a,
oh, yeah.
a of the fine dining restaurants. It's a Thomas Keller property.
We actually mentioned them a little bit when we were talking about them doing away with the tips for waiters.
Yes, exactly. We did. We talked about that with Le Bernardin and all those guys. Yeah. So there's an article that was just put out from the New York Times that was talking. food critic Pete Wells published a devastating review of Thomas Keller's Manhattan restaurant per se. Yeah, like massive. All right, so it knocked it all the way down. So per se was a 4-star restaurant in New York City, which is the New York Times highest rating. This says that until Wells knocked it all the way down to 2, given that dinner at four at per se easily cost $3,000, and 2 stars puts it on par with the vegetarian superiority burger on 9th Street. So now they're just a 2-star restaurant. So what happens to these guys?
How long do you think it took for Thomas Keller to hop on the plane and get down there?
I got a really weird feeling that he was out there on Tuesday morning.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, Wells' review was a masterpiece of critical viciousness, and it generated an earthquake of response on social media, overwhelmingly in agreement and characterized by rage. People who have eaten it per se seized the opportunity to tell the world that it was a waste of money or even a scam. People who have not eaten at per se because their idea of splurging is more like $100 a head weighed in with condescension for suckers who pay too much for dinner. I believe it's $325 a plate right now, and that or $325 a meal that doesn't include your booze. If you want to have a somm's decision, a sommelier's decision added in, then it bumps the price up big
and
time.
And if you want the full experience, if you are a drinker, you definitely want to go that direction.
Oh yeah. Absolutely.
How much does this affect? Do you think you as a chef, knowing these type of things, how much does this affect the people targeting his other places like French Laundry?
Well, one, I think that these places are going to be subject to ridicule no matter what's going to happen. Okay, I think that any place that has a reputation for what these guys have, whether it's Le Bernardin, whether it's per se, whether it's Le Bec Fin that was in Philadelphia, where he was a 4-star restaurant as well and lost a star, and he immediately rolled his sleeves right back up and he was right back in the kitchen, dude. Immediately back in the kitchen. Because as a chef, that's where it all starts.
Mm-hmm.
That's where we all started. I mean, that's the idea of this, is that we were cooks. And I remember years ago there was an article that was put out, and I have it somewhere in my file somewhere, that is about, you know, hey, chef, we miss you. And I think that was the lead into the article. I think that was the title of the article. And it talked about, we love seeing you on TV. We love hearing about you writing recipes and doing demonstrations and doing charity dinners and all the other stuff. But we really miss you in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And in a place like that, you know, I mean, I can totally see that. And I can almost, I mean, I don't know what Keller's going to do. I haven't read that much further into it to find out what he's going to do. But in this case, I have a feeling this guy was right back there. And actually, if I'm not mistaken, his wife is kind of director of operations. I think they had met a while back, and there's a really cool thing that was done about him. I mean, he's a wonderful man. I met him once before, an amazing chef, and sometimes things get away from you. But I think that this case was really tough. There was a lot of stuff that went on inside of it that was not, you know, I mean,
Now, having not read the review in its entirety, is this gentleman that wrote the Pete Wells is his name? Is the review valid? I mean, or is it just one? It's always just one person's review. But did he hit some points that really deserved it to drop the 2 stars?
Well, the article itself from Pete Wells was called "At Thomas Keller's Per Se Slips and Stumbles." So that's how it stopped off. So it says, the lady had dropped her napkin. More accurately, she hurled it on the floor in a fit of disillusionment, her small protest against a slow creep of mediocrity and missed cues during a 4-hour dinner at Per Se that would cost the four of us close to $3,000 later. Sometime later, a passing server picked up the napkin without pausing to see whose lap it was missing from, neatly embodying the oblivious sleepwalking that had pushed my guest to this point.
So
this had gone on through the entire meal. Really, you know, the restaurant's identity, the extent that one that is distinct from its owner and chef Keller is placed on fastidiously minding the tiniest of details. And that's the whole idea about all these stars and Michelin grading and the whole nine yards. It all comes down to it literally is the tiniest of details. You know, it's the difference between a 2 and a 3. It's the difference between a 3 and a 4. And it's a big deal. You know, these places, they can charge what they charge because of these stars. They charge these things because of that reason. You know, you're not only going in and getting the most amazing
culinarily advanced meal, you're paying for an experience, an ambiance. You're paying for a lifetime of memory from that one meal is really what it comes down to, in my opinion. I mean, that's the way that I see it. And that's, I think, the way that a lot of the world sees it, too. So here's the question. I mean, what happens now? Yeah. What happens now? Do they drop their prices because they're no longer a four-star restaurant? They're a two-star? I mean, how many two-star restaurants are in New York City?
Does it feel like, and maybe it's just me, but does it feel like some of these style places are kind of coming out of fashion, too?
Oh, my God, absolutely. Absolutely.
I wonder if a lot of that, too, is a little bit of blowback, you know? I mean, for some of these people involved, just because of that general, I don't know, feeling.
Well, first off, we as a nation, we as a world are much more casual than we ever have been.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that casual has been elevated to a level it's never been as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, look, what is casual these days? I mean, before here's a prime example. I went to see my I met a guy a couple of weeks ago. It was the first time I had met him. It was kind of a weird situation. But I had walked in and I was in sweatpants and a pair of flip-flops and a T-shirt because I had no idea I was going to be meeting this gentleman. And I was like, hey, I'm really sorry I'm so casual right now. I said, I didn't know that I was going to be meeting you. And he said, don't worry about it. I know what you're talking about. Look at me. And he had on a pair of loafers with Argyle socks, a pair of jeans with a brown braided belt on, with a plaid shirt that was tucked in and a dish towel over his shoulder. Well, we weren't the same. You were ready to go to work in what I would be wearing. You were doing the dishes in something that I would be wearing to go out for the night.
Yep.
You know, so we aren't the same, and we have a different idea of that. I mean, when was the last time? I don't know about you. When was the last time you put a tie on?
I do not wear ties.
Well, I don't wear them either. I wear bow ties.
Yeah, and you couldn't get away with that. I mean, I guess it's really kind of coming down to is the day of the sports jacket restaurant dead?
Yeah, you know what? I mean, there's so few and far between anymore. I mean, Philadelphia had we had Lebec Fenn, George Perrier was one of the greatest chefs in the world, and it was you know, that's what it was. Well, they closed.
Yeah,
they're gone, man. Say goodbye to Hollywood. El Bulli, it was the number one restaurant in the world. They're gone. They're closed. It's no longer there. You're never going to see them again. Per Se just went from 4 to 2 in a matter of a 4-hour service period. Now, it didn't just happen in a 4-hour service period. Obviously, these are things that have happened through time. I mean, you don't just not pick up a napkin on the floor. There's a training that goes into that. You know, there are people, literally, they're captains walking through the dining room all the time. And the funny part about it, the neat part about it is they're like nondescript. They're just very gently almost floating through. And that's why they are so good, because you're not sensing that this is happening over your shoulder. But when something needs to happen, it just happens. Well, they've skipped that beat.
And do you drop your pricing to match the rating, or do you keep it and try to redefine what you're rated, you know?
Well, I think that's the biggest question right now is, well, how can you charge me this amount of money if I'm not gaining the experience? I'm paying $3,000 for four people for a meal at a 4-star restaurant. I mean, now you're a 2-star restaurant, dude. You're in the likes with, hold on, let me see this.
Do we know how long the wait is to even get a table at Per Se?
I don't know, but I had heard about, I don't know.
Yeah. But we're talking about places that's months in advance.
Yes. Well, I mean, here's 3-star. So here's the Michelin 3-star list of in New York City. So 3 stars, which is characterized as exceptional cuisine worth a special journey. Okay, so you're a destination spot. So we've got Chef's Table at Brooklyn Fair, 11 Madison Park, Jean Georges, Le Bernardin, Massa, and Per Se. Okay. Yep. Now, 2 stars, which is excellent cuisine worth a detour, okay, is Aqua V. There's only 11 or 12 of those. And there's 12 of those. So there's 6 3-star restaurants in New York City. Well, now there's 5. Now, do you, you're right. I mean, I don't know what you do in that case.
Yeah.
You're obviously, I mean, in my opinion, if you drop from 4 to 2, dude, you're shutting down for a week. You're shutting the place down for a week.
Maybe rebranding it.
I wouldn't go as far as rebranding because of the fact of who they are and the reputation. I mean, this is Thomas Keller.
Give him the chance to give it back.
He's the modern day godfather for what it is that we look at. Give them the opportunity to get it back. But you really have to pull it back in, and you have to retrain. You stop what you're doing immediately, and you start at the basics again.
Mm-hmm.
And that means we didn't get far into it to find out exactly what the food, three dishes, all of which Mr. Keller were made famous years ago at the French Laundry in Napa Valley, show his rare combination of American playfulness and rigorous finesse. One could argue that it's a little lame that Mr. Keller is still trotting them out. The name per se, after all, was chosen to suggest that New York would simply not reflect California's glory. This would be a landmark restaurant in and of itself. So here the reviewer is saying, like, you've got three dishes from a California cuisine on a New York City menu.
What's going on here?
Yeah, not only that, but dude, they've been around for 15 years.
Yeah.
Why are you doing that?
Well,
you know, here's 325 servers in an heirloom, furniture in place, the salmon tartare and the creme fraiche fitted into an ice cream cone the size of a AAA battery, the oysters and pearls, a savory tapioca pudding under caviar and warm oysters, the cinnamon sugar donut hole. So he's talking about these dishes that have been around for years. That they're still on the menu.
Well, you know, I can't from a standpoint of someone who does cocktail menus, you know, I can't argue with that, you know, but if they're not executed properly, that's another thing. But I'm definitely a big fan of putting classics and even modern day classics on my menus, you know.
Well,
like I like to put those drinks that might have been around for, you know, a decade or so that have been created by some of the top modern guys. But to me, it sounds like there's even a larger problem going on here than just that, you know?
Well, and here they go into, the kitchen could improve the bacon-wrapped cylinder of quail simply by not placing it on top of a dismal green pulp of cooked romaine lettuce. Crunchy and mushy at once, draining off the gluey, oily liquid would have helped a mushroom pot pie from turning into a swampy mess. So he's ripping apart everything. It's not like he just went in and pulled a star because of the fact that they had a bad experience with the service. He's ripping the food apart too. So you are now stopping the mainstay of what you were built. You built this brand based on the food and the service and everything. It's a good point. Do you pull your pricing back?
Yeah. Do you think people are pulling their reservations?
Wow, I don't know about that one. I'd like to see, and we'll have to follow up on this a little bit as we move forward, because I kind of have some point. You know, I kind of have a couple of thoughts about this for a lot of the people that we work with, which are people that aren't, they're not the three star. You know, they're not that level of what they're doing. But I really want to talk about that because I think there's a lot of things with this that are really prevalent in today's world. So
this is a cool one to keep track of because we have the ability to everyone has the ability right now to watch firsthand what literally the general in the food revolution is really going to do to attack this situation.
Sure. You know? Absolutely. I mean, that's a big thing, man. I mean, this is massive to think about that. So I think, you know, on another level with us and with our clients and the way that we do things, I mean, I think it really does bring it back to I'm an enormous, enormous fan and proponent. I'm constantly talking about the need for education within our restaurants that we you know, when you open a restaurant, you spend 2 weeks, okay, with your staff on an average opening 7 to 14 days, but you spend that time with your staff where there's a lot of team building. For my clients, I try to get a lot of team building. When the chairs come in, I want the staff there. I want them to unwrap the chairs. I want them to put the tables together. I want them to take the silverware out of the plastic when it first gets there and run it through the dishwasher, and the dishwasher running it through twice to make sure it's clean. Like, there's something to be said about an opening staff. There's a tremendous amount of respect for what happens in the restaurant, for the way that the equipment is handled, the way the plates are handled, the way the glasses and the bottles are all handled.
And people start fitting into where you can tell that they're going to be leaders or followers.
Absolutely. You're so right. It's such an integral part, and you nailed it right there, because this is where, as everybody knows, I talk about my 20-60-20, but this is where you see these people. You know, the ones that are standing around saying, well, what time are we going to be done today? Are we almost done? Are we going to get out of here? What time can we get out of here? I'd really love to go out tonight. Like, what kind of time can I get out of here?
Yep.
When, you know, then there's Joni who's over in the corner, and she's like, well, when we're done, We still have silverware that we have to fold, and we still have this stuff. Well, I'm not making any money because I'm not getting tipped and this and that. You know, there's a lot of bitching that goes on with that. Hopefully we weed them out through the interview process, but you're right. You see their true colors right here.
Yeah, and usually if you've created a strong enough staff around them, they weed themselves out anyway.
Exactly. So so during that time frame, though, there's this week-long period that I try with my staff where I love to get them into the restaurant. I want them to sit down. I go through every – first thing I do is a PowerPoint, man. I do a PowerPoint of the menu. Here's our menu. These are our appetizers. Let's do appetizers. And we go in. So let's say we're doing – let's just say something as simple as we're doing a Caesar salad. Okay, so in the Caesar salad goes romaine. In the dressing, I've got egg, I've got oil, I've got mustard, I've got lemon juice, I've got salt, I've got pepper. And, you know, I add in the additional ingredients, I talk about that stuff. I make sure that the staff sees it and they taste it and they look at it and they feel it. So they know exactly what is in that dish. Because when it comes down to that point of when I come in and sit down and say, hey, can I have the onion burger without onions? And they go, well, hold on, let me check with the kitchen. We didn't do your job.
Yeah.
You know, and we all have a world of exceeding expectations where when we as owners, operators, as consultants, whatever it is that we do, our job is to exceed the expectations of our guest, of our client, of every single part. If I'm walking into a dive bar, guess what? And I put a napkin down in front of you. Guess what? I just exceeded your expectation just by placing a napkin.
And, you know, and this is such a tough thing as a consultant. But I have been put into those situations, opening up locations where things got pushed back and you were literally opening at the beck and call of the owners who were trying to were becoming less cash liquid and were rushing to get those doors open and not being able to train a staff fully or to be able to put the program together to where you needed it once you were already in the location before you opened. And that rush is sometimes so just cancerous later on within the staff or the program or everything that you're doing that, you know, to me, the best thing that owners can know is that the most important time is that training right before you open. And do not rush it. And I had to learn those lessons as a consultant the hard way. And now, you know, when I'm opening up a new place, I definitely put in there that you have to give me this time frame because I'm adding my name to it.
Sure.
And things like this don't happen, you know?
Well, and I talk about it all the time where with the training and what happens with that is, you know, when you go in, you start off for the first year, the first month of opening, whatever it is, you have your staff that's been there with you for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
They were there for 2 weeks leading up to it. They were able to see the menu, feel it, touch it, hold it. And then they were there for that week right before we opened where they were able to taste everything and see and meet with the chef and go through that. So now let's fast forward 3 months, okay? So 3 months comes on. We're open. Now I hire a waitress and she comes in. Let's just say she comes in a week early. Okay, or not even that. Let's say she comes in 3 days early. She comes in 3 days early. We give her a training. We show her the menu. A manager might go through that menu with her, or if we're a chef. I used to love going through menus with my waitresses all the time. I would sit down with a new waitress and go through the menu with her so she understood what I was trying to do. And that was really important to me, and I have a lot of waitresses and waiters that really liked me doing that with them because they got an understanding of feeling of passion behind the food that I was doing, plus ingredients and everything else. But so now you're 3 months in. So now I'm just, you know, now I'm handing you a menu and 3 days later and I'm saying, okay, well, let's watch you on the floor. You can train with her for 5 days. Okay. So now we train with her for 5 days. Now fast forward 6 months or 9 months. Now you're hiring a waitress and saying, hey, here's a menu. Take a look at this. Go home. We're going to give you a test the next day. Then we're going to have you do a trail tomorrow and then you'll be on the floor on Friday.
Yeah.
To fast forward to 13 months, 14 months in. Now you're, hey, do you have any friends that can wait tables? You know, I mean, it's and the thing is we're bastardizing our brand. We're ripping our brand apart because we've walked away from the consistency of what it was, the vision, the mission statement, the roadmap to success, whatever you want to call it. We've bypassed that.
Yeah.
It's no longer there.
Yeah. And don't get me wrong, we can both operate underneath these high-pressure, quick situations where we're not able to necessarily do all the training that we need to, but we both know the best is the proof is in the pudding with training.
Sure. I mean, I still do. I mean, I had a call last Tuesday with clients of mine down in Cincinnati where we have put all the waitresses on the phone, and they're just motivational calls.
Yeah.
You know, we're trying to get the staff built back up.
Yeah, that's another thing, is incentivizing, you know, empowering the staff. You know, that's very, very important.
Oh, big time. And you know what? And look, we're not talking about the Perseids of the world, and we're not talking about the LaBernadettes of the world right now. We're talking about the average guy, female, man, whoever, owner, the average owner who has a bar, a restaurant, you know, that's something that's a little bit nice. Or maybe not so nice, but it really does come down to training, because if you're not teaching your staff what it is that you want, what your vision of what it is, what you feel, then guess what? They're going to do their own thing.
And you couldn't have said it better.
I mean, you know, it's that simple. And I always say to, you know, when owners call me, and I said it last week too. When owners call me and say, I got to get rid of this guy, I got to fire this person, I have to get rid of that. And I say, have we done everything in our power to give them the tools that they need to succeed? You've got to teach them. You've got to spend time with them. You've got to let them taste it. You've got to let them see it. And that goes across the board. Every single day you should be doing, you know, Russell, you should be putting a drink out. Whether it's an old classic that's been on the menu for 10 years, so they know what's in that drink. They taste it. They smell it. Plus, it gives you as a manager an opportunity to make sure that your bartenders are making the drink the right way. You know, they're following through with what they have to do. And I do this in pre-meals on a daily basis with a lot of my clients.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I did it in my restaurants as well, where I would bring out one of our classic dishes, whether it was the signature Duffy Burger, whatever it was called. We would bring that signature Duffy Burger out, and then I would bring two specials out. And say, hey, here's this. This is, I know you guys have seen this 50 times before, but I just want to remind you, it's brioche bread. It's this mix. It's got salt and pepper. It's got this. It's got that. And everybody looks at it and goes, yep, same great burger we've always had. And well, then our specials for today are this, this, and this, you know?
Yeah, it's like that, you know, Bourbon and Branch, you know, we'd always have those features, whether or not it'd be the feature that was invented with the stuff that we were bringing in that day, or the old classic that was either a new classic or an old classic that we just wanted to do again that day, just to hone those skills and show everybody we still got it.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. We still got it. But it's, and there's so much that goes into that 15 minute period during the day where you're spending the time to educate your staff again. You know, it's like a nurse who goes back in for training. It's like a doctor who goes to these classes and all the other stuff.
And I always thought those were the coolest times too. Not just as being part of the staff and getting those 15 minutes where you call the staff together and you showed them everything, but also being as on the side of being the one that leads those kind of staff meetings, it's always cool to, you know, that it's that moment of the day where everybody kind of stops what they're doing. They have that social aspect with each other, and they get to share in this education, and then also they get to taste and see some stuff, you know?
Yep, exactly. And then
my favorite part.
Well, and it's that chance where everybody's together for a little bit.
Yeah. My favorite parts were that part, and then counting the money at the end of the night with everybody having that shift drink.
Yeah. I just like counting the money at the end of the night. Just like counting the money. I got my hundos in my pocket. Yeah. I had a partner who used to count the money, and then he'd go to the night to the club and do coke on the back of a toilet. It was awesome.
Yeah, yeah. Or I'd worked at places where people were doing that while they were making the money.
There you go. What did somebody ask? Somebody sent us something last week. What was one of the craziest things that you've seen in restaurants or whatever it was? I think, hold on, let me find this real quick.
Oh, no, that was me asking Brad Bohannon what was the craziest thing he's seen.
Oh, okay, all right. Well, no, there was also, I think my brother asked a question. Yeah. Any, no. Here we go. This is some chick named, no, Mike, here it is. What's the craziest story you know involving a kitchen walk-in? That was my brother who asked that question. Extra points if it involved you. And I actually replied when I walked into the walk-in and saw two people having sex. Now, it didn't involve me. Yeah, just walked in and they were just having sex. And the funny part is they weren't like, oh, shit, chef, I'm really sorry. They were just kind of like, we're almost done, dude.
Yeah. They look at you like, get out of here.
Get out.
Get out of here.
We're almost done. Yep, almost done. Unbelievable. Awesome. But, yeah, so it's a shame, man. I really do. I think it's going to be something that's going to be fun to follow in the next couple of months to really see what happens, what decisions Keller makes, what decisions Keller's team makes. And you know, do you lower your prices now?
But hey, you know, Thomas Keller, I believe in you, brother.
Yeah, no, I don't have a worry about that at all. I really think that I'm excited, because I think that what's going to come out of that is one, they're going to have a whole new round of food. There's going to be a new round of food coming out. Plus, I think that there's going to be some little things that I don't know. Do I think they're going to stick with what they have as per se? Or maybe do they rebrand? I don't know, man.
I just think it's going to be very interesting, the direction that he goes with it. And I think that it'll be something that, depending upon how it works out, may or maybe taught in hospitality courses for a while, or you know, either as a success story or what not to do. But you know, he's in the hot seat right now.
Yeah, I mean, people don't eat like that anymore, dude. People do, don't get me wrong, but the masses don't.
Maybe you use this as a chance to redefine that branding, or maybe you use it as a chance to try to reinvigorate it. Yeah. I'm very interested to see where he goes.
It's going to be awesome, dude. That'll be a good one.
Yeah, yeah.
So that'll be good.
Good luck, Thomas Keller.
Yeah, come on, brother. Knock it out of the park. Ay, ay, ay. All right.